Welcome to episode 44 of Amenal's World. And my guest this week is another lovely lady who I met on Twitter. Yes, I know that's been the running theme of this podcast. But this week I spoke to Maryam Namazi. She is a human rights activist. And what fascinates me about Maryam so much is that everything that she's managed to achieve throughout the last couple of decades has been without the use of social media. And I feel that right now as a generation, as a campaigner, as an activist, or someone who's really trying to have a positive impact on society, we rely so heavily, not just to spread information and spread messages that we believe in, but also to some degree is a source of inspiration for us as well. I mean, without the internet, without Instagram or YouTube, I think I would have probably been afraid to do what I did. And this is why I wanted to get Maryam on the show, because her work is based around actively campaigning against Sharia law. And of course, you can read about her, all the work that she's done online and the backlash that she has faced, especially as someone who's critiqued the treatment of women under Islamic regimes. And I mean, that's something that takes a lot of courage and it's not easy to do. And when I spoke to Maryam, as you will hear, a lot of her attitude towards everything is that, well, this is what I believe in, this is what I'm going to do, and I don't really care what anybody else thinks. But when I spoke to Maryam, I wanted to know more about Maryam the woman, Maryam the lady, Maryam the young girl who was born in Iran, because that's the story. These are the stories that shape these incredible people who come on the show. And speaking to Maryam was so enlightening. I'm so grateful that she gave me her time, and I really hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did speaking to her. Welcome to the show, Maryam. It's so lovely to speak to you. I've read so much about you. I've been so excited to speak to you, and I know that we've been connected for a while. So thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited to finally meet you face to face as well. Given that I know about the work you've been doing, and I guess that's how we met when you first went out to protest for more PPE as a pregnant NHS staff person. And, you know, so so it's great to finally meet face to face.
Yeah. And Maryam, this happens to be that every guest I've had on the show over the last few weeks has been someone I've met on Twitter. And I think that this year has been great in that way, that I've connected with so many amazing people online like yourself. I remember when I went out to protest last year, you either tweeted or you messaged, or we connected, and you showed your solidarity. And that meant so much to me, because at that time when I felt so alone, I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing. You know, you showed your support, and that gave me so much courage. So thank you for that, Maryam.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I mean, I think it's the responsibility of everyone to do that. And it is, it was an image of being very alone, in the sense that you were on your own with your placard, but there was all this support behind you, and you were also representing so many others who weren't there with you that day. So I guess that is part of campaigning and organizing work, isn't it? Raising awareness and bringing people together for something that's really necessary and needed. So I think it's the least anyone can do is to show that support and solidarity.
Yeah, it's strange, because there's such a huge disparity to how it started off and how everything is going now, at a time when I felt so afraid and so alone. I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing. To see all the support we're getting now and the encouragement now, I never thought this would happen a year on. But Maryam, I'm lucky, because we're living at a time now where social media is so powerful that people can connect through that. And when you started off doing what you were doing, you didn't have this, or you had very little of it at least. So let's go all the way back to when, you know, you were a young girl in Iran. What was it like at that time as a young girl, like to speak up in general? Were you someone who always spoke up anyway? Because my mom tells me I was always a big mouth. what was it like for you? I mean, were you always questioning things? Were you always asking questions that maybe you weren't allowed to?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, going back to your point about the fact that things are so different now with social media, and it's true, because in a sense, before social media, I think a lot of us felt very invisible, in the sense that our voices never got anywhere and no one really heard us. And it did seem like you're screaming in the wind, you know, on your own in a sense. So for me, I felt, in a sense, I never felt that I was being silenced because I come from a very strict but very open-minded family. So it wasn't as if I felt that I was being stifled. I work with a lot of young women who have been abused and, you know, facing violence and threats and ostracization, shunning because of what they think and who they are. And I never did feel that. I always had the support of my family and I continue to have that support. So really the tipping point for me was when an Islamic movement took power in Iran. And even though it was a dictatorship prior to that as well, it was the Shah's dictatorship. It wasn't a, you know, free country by any means. It still had, there were still political prisoners, religion still played a role in the state and in the law. But obviously a theocracy is a very, very different thing. And so that's where for me, things became very clear on how difficult and how unfair religion is in women's lives. Because, you know, my parents are Muslim, but it was never the case where I had to wear the veil or go to an Islamic school or memorize the Quran or pray five times a day. I didn't have any of that. So, you know, that for me was the change that came about. And I was just going into my teens at that time.
So, Mariam, at that time, were you also, when you were going to school, for example, your neighborhood kids, and were they raised in a very similar environment to you as well? Or were you, would you say, the odd one out?
I think, you know, there were a lot of kids like me as well. And it's interesting because the world has changed so much in the past 40 years that it seems that if you were secular and you didn't wear the veil, you were an odd one out. But that's not the case then. You know, I think from my we had some members in our family that veiled. My grandmother sometimes wore the veil, as far as I can remember. And we had relatives that would fast during Ramadan, or as we call it, Ramzan, and then others who didn't fast. And it was never about, oh, you must respect culture and you must respect religion. You have to fast and you have to wear the veil. You know, this is something, and I think people who see photos of Iran 40 years ago or Afghanistan, you know, or Iraq, it's very different than what it looks like today. And I think that's why it seems like what we're saying just seems so odd. But in reality, there were lots of people who were secular. And even when the Iranian government, the theocracy, came into power and decided to impose compulsory veiling rules, a lot of there was this huge march for women's rights and against compulsory veiling in Iran. And lots of veiled women also came out and marched, because it was very much seen to be a choice. So you had women being interviewed who had the chador on saying that I don't want my daughters to be veiled if they don't want to be. And so it has changed a lot. So, and I think today too, when you look at the fight in Iran, for example, against compulsory veiling rules there, you see that that's culture, you know, of autonomy and women's liberation continues in a way. So I feel like I'm a product of that sort of open-mindedness, but also ongoing battle and challenge.
Mariam, where are your parents originally from? Are they both from Iran as well, or?
My it's interesting because my father is Iranian, but he was born in Calcutta because my grandfather was an Islamic scholar. I'm not allowed to call him a mullah because, you know, mullahs have a very bad name in Iran. So my family has said, I have to call him an Islamic scholar. And, you know, they explained that he was an intellectual and he taught Arabic and Islamic theology at university in Calcutta. And so that's why my father was born there. And out of the eight siblings, some are born in Najaf in Iraq, some were born in Calcutta, some were born in Bangalore, some were born in
Wow.
Shiraz. So it was a very, they moved around quite a bit. And so when my father was in Calcutta, he remained there until he finished university. And then the family went back to Iran. But he met my mother there. And my mother is Nepalese from Kalimpong, which is a small place close to Darjeeling by the Himalayan mountains. So she's from Kalimpong, and she had met my father at a party, and she followed him back to Iran after knowing him for a very short period of time. So that's the background. So my mother was not Muslim, but she converted to Islam to marry my dad.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So, Mariam, you're just talking about all these different places, and I'm just imagining the Himalayas and like just daydreaming, like one day maybe when this pandemic is over, can travel and enjoy the beauties of that India especially has to offer. But have you ever been like traveling to India? Have you met your extended family in Nepal as well?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because my mom is three sisters, and one married a Muslim, that my mom, another married a Hindu, and the third one married a Christian who's atheist. And before the revolution, while we were in Iran, we used to visit my grandmother in Kalimpong. So I had been there a few times. And also, they have a very famous hotel there. It's not in the family anymore, but it was the Himalayan Hotel, and it's where the first expeditions to on Everest took place. Started off from their hotel, and also, Shirley MacLaine visited the hotel. She's done a book, "Don't Fall Off the Mountain," and my mom is mentioned in the book as well.
Oh,
So she's got that history behind her. So I did visit, and actually, after we realized that we have to leave Iran because the schools were closed, and we weren't planning on leaving the country permanently, but my mother just brought me to India to study because the schools were closed in order to Islamicize them, and they thought it's good to leave me in school in India so I can carry on my education. And I was about 13 at the time, and then return. She was going to return back to Iran. So she had left my 3-year-old sister with my dad. She was going to go back. But things started getting more and more difficult. So my dad told my mom not to come back. And so we stayed in India for a few months until my dad was able to join us with my little sister at the time. So it was a shock for us because when you think you're going back and then you never can go back again, and you don't really say your goodbyes, you leave everything behind. It's quite a traumatic thing to happen in your life. And I don't know, the older I get, I find that it's even more traumatic. Rather than getting easier, I find I miss it more. I feel more upset by the whole thing. I guess when you're younger, you kind of just manage, and you, or if you're in the process of it, you're so busy trying to survive and figure out what needs to be done that you kind of push that behind and you start thinking about it later, maybe.
No, I
And it's
agree with
okay.
that, Mariam. You know that even now, as I mean, I've just had Radhika as well, and it could be that I'm a new mother, but I feel that as we grow older, we gain more wisdom, and that wisdom allows us to reflect more. And I think that's why now you're probably thinking back at that time, thinking how difficult it must have been as a child, because when you're that young and you're going through that kind of experience, you're just on fight or flight mode, and I guess you're just trying to go get on with everything and just try to just go with the flow day by day. And I think that, as we grow older, we read more, we learn more about other people's experiences, and we gain that wisdom. And I think that's probably why. So maybe now that you're saying that, I think in the next 10, 20 years, I might be thinking, oh, well, there's so much more to it. But Mariam, you spoke about how things started to change in Iran. And I mean, I went out last year and I protested. But for me, now that I reflect on it, and I think, again, it's one of those things that will take time for me to fully reflect on everything and dissect it, because
it was a big step that I took. And I, the more I think about it, I realize, Miriam, is that there have been lots of instances in my life where I felt that I had to speak up, but I was too afraid to. And the times I did speak up, I realized that there were consequences. So the next time I didn't. I think all of those experiences put together led me to that day to go out in Downing Street, because I think for me, it was like that tipping point. I almost just got fed up and said, look, I'm not going to listen to anybody. I'm just going to do what I feel is right. What was that tipping point for you? Because you saw a lot, you experienced a lot as a young girl. Was there anything in particular that affected you or your family for you to say, okay, I think I need to speak up now?
I mean, I think I've always spoken up really as long as I can remember. And I wonder if maybe because you were pregnant, you felt like you needed to speak up because you had a responsibility to a child now that was coming into the world, and it wasn't just about you anymore. And I wonder how much that has an effect, an impact on whether we decide to speak out or not. Because sometimes I think we can take a lot of personal abuse. Do you know what I mean? We can just manage it somehow, and personal trauma. And sometimes it does reach a point where you kind of feel like it's not just about you, it's about lots of other people. And it makes it easier to speak out in that case, I think, than, you know. But I'm trying to think, I mean, I don't think, I mean, obviously the whole experience of leaving one's country is a very, very big, it has a big impact. And we were in India for 2 years. We weren't really given permission to stay on. Then we came to the UK for a year. We weren't allowed to stay here after a year either. And then we went to the US, and because my uncle and there was a few family members there who said, come here. And also there, you know, we had our passports confiscated at the airport, and we were basically, you know, we pretended we were going for a holiday, you know, as a way of getting in, obviously, because, and then we managed to get residency once we arrived there after a few years. So it was constant movement and not really feeling secure and that you will have a place to call home. And I think also, you know, the whole concept of traveling on a travel document, you know, the amount of harassment and abuse at various borders and from immigration, and this constant feeling of never knowing if you will be safe somewhere, you know. So I think all of that has to do with making it easier to speak up, because you have a lot to I don't know. I can't really explain, because sometimes it might be because you have nothing to lose, but there's always something to lose. Because I remember, I don't know, someone once, I overheard someone saying that, oh, you know, she can speak up like this because she's a refugee. She doesn't have family in Britain. She doesn't care what people think. But that's, again, not true, because you do always have family. You do have loved ones that you're worried about. And so it's, you know, there's no one answer, is it, on what makes people speak up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Miriam, you've been quite successful in your campaigning and putting your thoughts and ideas across. And I believe a lot of that is down to the opportunities you've had to speak up freely. And, well, in some parts of your campaign, and you've had those opportunities where you can speak up, people will listen to you, and change has happened. You have created change. What do you think are the, I would say, the downsides of having this freedom of speech as well? Because I feel that this year we've seen extremes from all angles. We've seen people speak up for the right reasons and create positive change. But then obviously we saw what's happened, for example, in the US when Biden was elected. We saw what happened at the Capitol, the US Capitol. That was also because freedom of speech allows them to do this to some extent. So you've lived in a country where maybe speaking up was not allowed and it wasn't as easy, but you've also lived in countries where speaking up has been just as easy. So what are your thoughts on this, Miriam? Because I feel like we live in a world where we're living in two extremes, but I think that to achieve some sort of equilibrium, we need to sort of meet in the middle at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, there's two parts to this. One is that, of course, we live, living in Britain, for example, we're safe compared to someone living in Iran or Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, and we're able to speak. But we also have to remember that sometimes taboo, things that go against the mainstream, they're not always easy to say, easy to hear, and still it has with it a level of insecurity. So it could reach a point where you can be killed, for example, in Paris because you draw a cartoon, the Charlie Hebdo example. So, and that fear, you know, the thing is that you just have to have a few cartoonists killed in order to create a blanket fear. Do you know what I mean? It's not, it's sometimes when you look at the fear, it's not equivalent with the number of people killed. That's not how it works, but it's a way of silencing people. And there is a lot of fear around this issue. And I found that the most surprising thing, that how many people who are born and raised in this country are fearful to talk about some of these issues. But also, I mean, on the issue that you raised on the sort of polarization, the reality is that that polarization has always been there. Somehow on social media, it is, you know, it's sort of, it's increased tenfold, a millionfold, basically, because we see it more visibly. But that polarization has been there as long as people have been fighting for a change, you know, and you see it sometimes and you don't see it sometimes. Social media has given visibility in a way that we didn't have before. But I think that that's not, the problem is not free speech. Because in a sense, you know, a lot of the things I say, some might consider hate speech because they think criticizing Islam is hateful, criticizing the hijab is hateful. And my argument is that, well, Islam is an idea, we should be able to challenge it in the same way that you have a right to challenge my beliefs. And the hijab is, you know, even though we want to protect women who wear the hijab and make sure that they're never attacked or face any bigotry, we also have those of us who've fought to remove the hijab, who fought to for it to be not compulsory on women, for example, we have a right to be able to challenge it as a tool that is used to manage women's sexuality and is used to erase women from the public space. So what I want to say is that hate speech is not so clear. It's not so clear cut, because what one person considers hateful, another person can consider a matter of, I need to criticize Islam as a matter of my survival. Do you know what I mean? As a matter of my defense of human rights, for example. And of course, there is real hate, not hate against ideas, but hate against people. And we saw that during the Trump campaign, the rise of white supremacy and white nationalism, which is very much part of the far right movements that we're seeing on the rise in the UK. And we've seen that, for example, with the EDL, with Britain First, the Brexit campaign, a lot of it was based on this sort of toxic hate for the other and the foreigner. And of course, Islamic fundamentalism, Islamism, is also very much part of that far-right movement. I think, though, obviously, when it comes to violence, inciting, you know, the sort of terror and violence against people, that doesn't fall under speech any longer. But when it comes to speech, I think we shouldn't have any limits. If speech is bad, the only way to confront the bad, so-called bad speech of the fascist is with better speech that's anti-fascist, you know. But if you censor bad speech, you only force it underground where you can't confront it in the public space. And so I think we shouldn't be afraid of these confrontations, as long as it doesn't lead to violence. We should be able to have the most difficult conversations, and we have to have them, because the fascist that comes on Twitter is part of a movement that exists on the ground in real life that is affecting the lives of many people, like the Islamic fundamentalist, like the Christian right winger who's bombing abortion clinics, like the Hindu right winger that's killing Muslims for eating beef in India, like the Buddhist right wing, you know. So these have to be confronted, I think, and speeches, you know, when you look at the question of speech, it's one of the most fundamental human rights that exists, because it is really the only things we who don't have power have in order to challenge those who are in power. And if we accept limitations, we are the first ones who are going to be limited, because the powerful always have the right to speak. And they have all the state machinery and mechanisms to make us listen to what they have to say, you know, whereas we don't. And so I think it's one of those rights that we really need to protect and cherish.
Well, Mariam, I think what you just said there was just made something click in my head just now, is that because social media has played such a big role in our society, what we see online, like the fascists and the extreme right wingers, I think it's very hard for us to connect that to real life scenarios. We see them troll us on social media. We see them put all their opinions out, but to actually visualize them out there protesting is something that we can't connect the two with, because everything on social media has become so saturated now that we fail to understand the impact that has on the real world. Now, Mariam, what you have done and what you're doing as a campaign and activist is not very light. It's something that people are very passionate about, and something that people in some parts of the world can get killed for speaking up against. And, you know, you speak about the critique, and you critique the treatment of women under Islamic regimes. Now, when you first started speaking up about these things, what were your biggest challenges and what were your biggest fears? Because, as I said, at that time, it must have been a bit more of a lonely space, because you don't have that solidarity on the internet, for example, as we have now.
I mean, you know, I never really felt lonely, because I always, I come from the experience of Iran, which has one, a tradition of critical thinking and free thought and atheism historically as well. And also a revolution that was not Islamic to begin with. It was against the Shah's dictatorship. It was taken over by the Islamic movement. It was suppressed by the Islamic movement. But that sort of revolutionary perspective has continued throughout the four decades that the Iranian government's been in power. So it's very much there, I think. It's a left-leaning, very fundamental criticism of religion's role, of the status of women, of secularism, the importance of secularism. I think if you look at the various protests that come out of Iran, they are very modern, very secular, very universalist. And I mean, one of the placards that women held up during the 1979 March 8th protest against compulsory veiling in Iran was neither Eastern, neither Western, but universal. You know, and so for me, I've never felt like I'm on my own, which is why it's a very different experience for me, and I think those of us who come from this political background. And I was shocked, for example, when I started the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain in 2007, to find that there were people who were born and raised in Britain who were British citizens. They're not immigrants, maybe their families were, but but they were there, you know, I guess the white supremacists always think they're immigrants, but in reality, you know, they are British born. And yet they felt too scared to talk about these issues, and they felt very alone and very desperate. And one of the things that people kept saying when the Council of Ex-Muslims was established was that now I don't feel alone anymore. And I found that astonishing, because I've never felt alone, you know. So it does, I think it's very much that experience of mine that helped push me along. Even if I was physically alone, but I felt I wasn't, you know. And it became more clear to me when I saw how many British born young people felt so different from the way I felt.
Mariam, a few months ago, I had one of my guests, Jasvinder Sangera. She was speaking to me about how she went through a forced marriage herself, and how she broke away from that, and she set up Karma Nirvana, a charity which helps other women go through this, and she counsels them and she helps them. When she told me that when she started this, she couldn't actually advertise herself as a charity for helping women in forced marriage or abusive marriage, for example. She had to advertise herself as saying, oh, I've got these Zumba classes for South Asian women, come and join me. And then from there, she would start talking to them and start to explain to them, you know, the help that she can provide them with. To start off something like you did, the Council for Ex-Muslims, was it as easy as saying, okay, this is what I'm going to set up, this is my office, come here, I'm going to talk to you? Or did you have to sort of make it, I guess, like an underground sort of project to get people to come to you? Because this is the kind of thing where you have to sort of attract people, because people are usually too afraid to come to you for this kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there are other examples, like, I guess, Southall Black Sisters, where they never pretended they were having Zumba classes. They just stood there and they defended their position. And I think there is something about that gives strength and courage when very little of it seems to exist, you know. So I suppose from my perspective, our work was, the whole idea behind the Council of Ex-Muslims was that it is a public exhibition of our leaving Islam, of our criticizing Islam with our names, with our faces, as a direct challenge to the Islamist movement, but also apostasy and blasphemy law. So it was very much, everything we've done is public in that sense. Of course, you know, we've had to change tactics in some ways. For example, every time we held a public event, the Islamists would threaten the venue and we would either be kicked out or we wouldn't be allowed back again. And there was a lot of pressure because we were willing to take the risk, but very many people aren't. And so we now, for example, don't publish our venue until, except to those who are going to be attending. Not because that's our politics, but because the venues are such that if we mention them, then they'll be attacked and there'll be a lot of threats against them, and it will end up in our events being cancelled, for example. The other thing is, of course, our office, we have office space now, and we obviously don't have our name in neon lights outside the door. But again, that's because obviously a safety issue, but it's not that we're underground in the sense that we're not pretending we're Zumba lessons, but what we are doing is anyone who wants to meet with us will be given our address. So it's not a question of us, you know, it's not like a safe house, it is an actual working office. But, you know, we've learned that it's some things need, some precautions need to be taken in order to at least have some minimal safety rules. So I think, though, you know, people can understand that, because there is so much fear around this movement. So it is about balance. It's a balancing act, you know, challenging it publicly, not showing fear, because I think also the more people do that, the less afraid people are of them, you know, because one of the things I always hear is, look, she's been doing it for so long and she's still alive. Like, oh, that's, thank you very much. So I'm glad that gives you hope that I'm not dead yet. Yeah. You know, that sort of thing. And also the sort of public challenge. And I don't know, I think acts of courage also bring courage with it. Acts of hope bring more hope with it. And it has a, you know, a cumulative effect, and it becomes widespread. And I think there is, you know, that was something we could just imagine initially, but now, you know, 13 years on from the establishment of the Council of Ex-Muslims, it's very clear how what good politics that was, in the sense that now it's become a movement, really, with countless people who call themselves ex-Muslims and who are speaking, even if not publicly on the corner of their street where they live or where they work, but at least they're able to do it on social media, and more and more people see that and don't feel as alone.
Mm. Look, Mariam, you'd mentioned earlier that, you know, the venues that you announce prior to any meeting, you try to keep that right at the very end for safety reasons, but have you had any situation before where you have been attacked or any of your meetings have been interrupted?
Well, we instituted this. Well, we have, for example, we've had Islamists come into our meetings and the security guard saying, well, if you weren't talking about these issues, then you wouldn't have to have these problems, as if it's our fault for speaking up. You know, it's kind of like blaming the woman who's raped, saying it's the length of her skirt that caused the violence against her.
Well, that's the easiest option, right, Mariam? That's the thing. When you come,
that is, yeah.
when we have these discussions and people are pointing blame, some people have this, some people's brains are wired to find the easiest option and say, well, this person is to blame and end the story. When in fact, a lot of these issues, you actually have to engage intellectually to understand the realities behind it.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, there are cases at Goldsmiths University, for example, that became quite well known, because there was a video of the event where the Islamic Society came and tried to cancel the talk, intimidate people in the talk, threaten some of the people in my talk on blasphemy and apostasy under Islam. And when it was in 2014, we had a big conference, a two-day conference on secularism, and we had many, I think a majority speakers were women. Some of them were believing women, Muslim women as well, who came together to talk about the importance of secularism. And that was one of the events where the venue was published beforehand. That was the last time we actually did that, because the venue, it was a hotel by the Tower of London. They were threatened very seriously, and they took the threats very seriously. So they called the police in, and they threatened to cancel our talk, and they blamed it on our topic. And, you know, it was a very, very, very stressful few hours, because while we were meeting with them, we had speakers coming from all over the world, you know, and they were threatening to cancel the event, and they said that they've never had this problem before. And, well, I explained to them that it was because they'd never maybe had a conference with this topic before. And it wasn't even one about apostasy and blasphemy. It was about, you know, secularism and women's rights in the 21st century, something like that. So they had to hire a personal body, like a private security firm, to be there for the full 2 days. The police were involved in making sure things were safe. And it's interesting, because I got texts from Islamists outside telling me to come outside, that they wanted to talk to me. And they spent quite a large time of the event outside, just intimidating people, you know. And that's what they do. They're so good at intimidating people, aren't they? So, and I think it's that sort of thing that they do that makes it more and more difficult for people like myself to do the work that we do.
And Marian, this is one question I ask every campaign and every activist I meet, because one of my biggest challenges last year, especially, was trying to explain to my family what I was doing. Even though my parents know me better than anybody else, and they knew to some degree that Mila is not someone who'll just sit back and watch things happen. If she really believes in something, she will go out and fight. But they didn't think that I'd take it to that extent. I'd go outside Downing Street and protest. It took me a long time to explain to my parents what I was doing. But not just what I was doing, but why I was doing it and the meaning behind everything. Because personally, for me, it wasn't just I want PPE, you know, it was so much more than that. It was that people are dying. And if my parents were in that situation, I'd want someone to stand up for them. And I had to really explain this to them and, you know, emotionally connect with them in such a way that I've never done before in my life, because it was so important for me that they understood what I was doing and to some degree get their blessing to say, okay, go ahead. What was it like for you at that time, Maureen? Because now I think it's a bit easier to because we're living in a generation where, you know, people have seen much more of this kind of movement and protest. What was it like for you to explain to your to family what you're doing? And did you get any sort of lashback from that?
Can I just ask you something? So, did your parents not understand why you were doing that? Because that would seem so logical to me that. Were they were
They
they more
understood.
concerned about you rather than what you were doing? Were they worried like you shouldn't be doing this while you're pregnant or?
They understood what I was trying to do, but they didn't understand why I had to go outside Downing Street. They were like, "Can't you just like write a letter to Boris Johnson?" I'm like, "It's not that easy, and he probably just won't even like acknowledge it." They didn't understand the idea behind the protest and the movement I was trying to create at that time. And I think it's all down to that fear as people who've come from India to Europe, who've, you know, moved across, even though they have British passports, Miriam, to some extent, they were like, they might kick you out the country. It seems so absurd to say that out loud, but that's the fear we had. And, but it still meant so much for me to explain to them what I was doing. So what was it like for you at that time?
You know, I don't think I've ever explained my work to my family, and I kind of I just do what I do, and I basically just I'm like a bull charging forward. I mean, of course, a lot of what we do, you have to explain and try to bring people on board. Part of any social movement is explaining and persuading and mobilizing and bringing people together. So in that sense, I guess that's something I've done publicly. But I think, I don't know, in private, in the family, I mean, obviously, like any family, we've got, you know, a very wide range of differences of opinion. I think for a fa familial peace, you kind of keep politics and religion and things out. You don't talk about it. I mean, and that's the sort of place I'm in. And I usually don't really talk about things unless, of course, I have to, like something really gets on my nerves and I've got to say something. But generally, I try to steer clear from that. And I think maybe also now I don't, you know, I'm much older now, so I don't know, but I don't think I ever needed to. I mean, I know, for example, when I was just out of university, I went to Sudan for 2 years, and my parents didn't want me to go, but I never really listened to them. I feel sorry for them. They're such lovely parents, but I never listened, and that might be why it was easy for me, because I never had to explain or get their permission or listen to them.
I think that takes a lot of, and this is something that I've reflected on as well over the last few years, because I had lots of opportunities maybe to do something else, even in the last few years when I was studying medicine. There were other opportunities where I said, actually, I'm going to do this. But the emotional energy it takes to explain to people what you're doing sometimes is just not worth it. And I realized the impact that had on me last year. Not only was I scared to go out and do this, but then the added burden of trying to explain to my loved ones that this is what I'm doing and I feel it's right just adds an extra toll, and it actually takes away from the energy you could be putting into to your movement and your campaigning. But Mariam, just going back to what I said earlier on about wisdom, and that as you grow older, you start to read more and learn more and have more experiences, so you reflect on your past. Do you feel that over the years you've been able to some degree, because you know when you're campaigning and working at a level that you are operating at that level, a part of it is educating people and explaining to them your views and why you think that way. How has that changed from when you started to now? Because I feel in 1 year I've matured so much. And like last year, I was like, how do you not get it? Like, it's so simple. But, you know, to some people, you really have to break it down and sort of invite them into the conversation. How do you feel you've changed as an individual over the decades?
Well, I mean, I think I'm much calmer in the sense that I used to get very angry. And I mean, the things I've done.
Go on, tell me, Maria. This is a safe space.
I mean, I used to get very angry. So I remember, for example, when I was living in Sudan, because I was a single woman and because I came from Iran, they assumed I was Muslim and they could tell me what to do and how to behave. And I wasn't having any of it. And it was, I eventually got threatened by the security and I had to be quietly taken out of the country. So it ended like that. But for example, I remember like I was renting this place as part of a house, and the woman just used to come into through the door that was linked to her house. She used to just come into my place. And, you know, I what I did is I tied a rope to her door to a place so she couldn't open the door anymore. And I had lots of friends, like Ethiopian friends, Sudanese friends from my work as well, men as well. They used to come and visit me. It wasn't like they were my boyfriend or anything, but just like we were friends. And once the son of the family came and said, it's, you know, very haram. You're a young woman. You've got this man here coming. So like I took my belt out and I started attacking his car. I wouldn't hit him, but yeah. I was attacking his car and kicking his car. And it's like, that's the stuff I used to get really angry.
Yeah.
I have quite a temper still, but I've managed to control it. So I feel a lot calmer now in a sense. And I guess that comes with age and experience as well.
Mm.
But I find that, you know, no matter how many years you do this, you're bloody repeating the same thing over and over again. I feel like I want to just record my voice and press play, you know, for different questions and comments I get. Because it's like,
when you came on the podcast, I was like, I'm not going to go into all the campaigning and like that people can read on Wikipedia. Like, it's fine. I want to know Mariam the person. I want to know who you are. And I want to speak to you. I want to connect with you properly, because I feel like that's what a lot of people are struggling with, that they feel like they're repeating the same thing again and again. And it gets tiring. You get fatigued. I mean, I'm tired of talking about PPE as well. And it's only been 1 year.
Yeah, no, it's true. And also, I've realized very scarily that there's a whole new generation of people that have been raised under, you know, a sort of culture of identity politics, and they don't know the fights against, you know, across borders and across so-called identities, and the sort of international solidarity that those of us who are older know, you know. And I feel like, oh my gosh, it's like we have to go back to basics about basic. What is universal rights? What is secularism? Why is it important? And it is quite scary, because you kind of do realize why history repeats itself is because there are constantly new generations that are fed nonsense, honestly, a lot of nonsense. And you know, you unlearn that through lived experience and through the challenges that you face in life. And so, I don't know, I just worry how this information gets passed on. and how we can stop, you know, history repeating itself. It just can be quite daunting sometimes.
And Miriam, you've obviously gone around the world with your work, and now you're here in the UK doing your work here as well. Do you connect yourself with any certain identity? Like if someone says, where are you from? Or who are you? What's your background? Do you connect yourself with being from Iran? Or do you just, I think for me personally, I feel like I'm just a nomad because I've just gone everywhere. Like I don't have an answer for that. How would you identify yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I usually feel like you, where you work, where you live, that's where you belong. And I do think that we all belong to, you know, this great humanity. And I don't subscribe to sort of national borders and boundaries. But so having said that, and now that I have a son who's 14 living in Britain and born in Britain and who I always raised as British, I kind of feel like, you know, people like us are not as welcome as I always imagined, and that the concept of belonging is maybe more one-sided than reciprocal. And I think with Brexit and all of that, it's just become quite upsetting, and I feel less that way now. And strangely enough, the older I get, I feel more Iranian.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I think it's because it's not identity as a national identity or, but one, a political one, you know, that I feel so centered with the fight that's taking place there and its effects on my life here. I mean, I think identity politics is regressive in the sense that it's all about, you know, these very myopic identities that either want to show difference or superiority. And I think that, you know, those are things that harm us because we have to, no matter where we feel we belong, if we don't recognize that we're part of a larger human family, you know, it sounds cliche, but it, as long as we can't see that, if we don't see that, you know, things won't get better.
Yeah, no, I agree, Miriam. I think over the last year, one of the other realizations I've had is that the responsibility we have as a global citizen to have a positive impact on not just our local communities or societies, but on a global level as well. I mean, we're seeing like the farmers' protests in India. You know, how there's so much solidarity around the world. People feel they need to show their support. And I think that's just incredible. And, you know, I always think that through protesting, campaigning and activism, it's never people always think it's just if you look at a graph, it's just happy, 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 success, you know, change. Actually, it's not like that. There's so many peaks and troughs. And one thing that I found a bit difficult this year, to be honest, Miriam, is to sort of stay grounded to my cause because there's so much external noise happening and you can get distracted really easily. How do you stay grounded, Miriam? Because not only are you doing so much, but also you're doing something that's very difficult and scary as well.
I think for me, it's very much part of my life, so it doesn't feel like it's separate from my life in the sense that, okay, I'm an activist and this is what I do, but it's for me like breathing and eating and loving, and do you know what I mean? Because I feel like that's my responsibility as a human being on this earth, sort of thing, and it's part of what I do. And of course there's more defeats than there are successes, because we are dealing with states with huge amounts of power and we're minuscule compared to them, but our strength comes in numbers. And that's why activism matters, because in a way, then you're not alone. What you're striving for is something that a lot of people who might be silent also are striving or would want, but may not know how to do it or not want to do it publicly. And so I think for it, seeing the fact that there's so many out there who are supportive and other movements that really, like, I don't know, the movement in Rojava, you know, setting up a feminist center and a secular center in a war zone, it gives everybody hope and courage, you know. And seeing the women's unveiling movement, the movement in Iran against compulsory veiling, it gives everyone hope and courage. And I think, you know, hopefully what we do also gives others hope and courage, and you sort of build on that, and it helps you manage the defeats, which are much more in reality. But that's life. I think life is basically trauma and suffering and some few points of light and love, and you live for those points of light and love, but and you suffer through the rest of it.
No, I think that's a really good way of putting it, Mariam, because I feel that especially our generation, I don't know if your son probably feels the same way, that the idea of happiness has been fantasized and seems so easily achievable through what we see on social media. Because obviously what we see on social media are just highlight reels and clips of people's life. We don't see anything beyond that. And someone like yourself, who's gone through all these years of effort to campaign and be an activist, I think, you know, you said something that's very wise, that life really is full of trauma and suffering. And Mariam, just before we go, I want to ask you, there's someone out there listening right now who's maybe too afraid to speak up, or maybe too afraid to take a stand against something they feel is much more powerful than them. What would you say to them? What would be your advice?
I mean, I think, you know, it's hard to advise people on what to do, because everyone has to make their own choices and they have to live with their choices, you know, and that's what I always tell people is, you know best what you're able to do, what you can do, what you want to do. But if you want to do something, then you should try to do it, because that does make life more fulfilling. And I think the more, you know, the reality is that all of us need to find like-minded people in order to survive. So even if you don't become an all-out activist, just finding people who think like you, who question like you, who want to, who are not satisfied with the status quo, finding those people and linking with them, that can give a huge amount of peace of mind as well. Now, not every ex-Muslim becomes an activist, but you know, if they come to a support group or they join a social, no politics at all, no political discussions at all, but it feels good to meet other people like you, because you realize you're not crazy, you realize there are others like you, you're not alone. And I think that is hugely empowering for people, just not to feel alone, you know. And given that people do feel so alone, especially with social media, it's got such a way of, it's so great in connecting people, but it also can make you feel really alone and isolated. And, you know, there's no human touch there very often. And people can be so cruel in a way that they would never be face to face, you know. So in that sense, using social media to meet people, real live people who feel and think like you, is a great plus.
Yeah, and I think, Mariam, what you just said is just a very good example of that activism can happen on so many different levels of society. You don't have to be out there outside Downing Street. You don't have to be, you know, on the front page of a newspaper. You don't have to do any of that. Actually, it can happen even at home, just having a conversation with your parents or your siblings, for example. But thank you so much for joining me, Mariam. I really enjoyed this conversation. I'm not going to lie, I was a bit nervous before I joined the call, because I had a bit of a hectic day with Radhika and wasn't really sure how I would be feeling when I came on. But I'm really glad that we had this really nice chat. It's so lovely to get to know you better.
Yeah, you too, Manal. It was so lovely to chat with you, and you made me feel so comfortable. So it was very nice. And you know, it's just wonderful to meet you face to face. Congratulations again on little Radhika. She's so, so cute. That's so, I think having a child is another level of a pain and terror, but also such great pleasure and love. So
yeah,
it's bloody hard work as well, but it is worth it. It is worth it.
It is, Mariam. And one of the greatest things is that with the last years, I've met so many incredible people like yourself, that when Radhika grows up, I can say, look, this is Mariam. Be like her. And I hope we can personally all meet one day when all this is
that would be great. And Radhika has her own mom anyway, as an example. She doesn't need anybody.
Thank you, Mariam. Thank you so much.
Thank you again. Yeah, good luck with all your work as well. Thank you, Mariam. And hopefully, yeah, stay safe as well. That's the other big thing.
Thank you, Mariam.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in, and thank you, Mariam, as well, for giving me your time. Such a pleasure to speak to people like this, and I get so excited when I speak to people like Mariam and speak to people like Misam, like I did last week. And I have another amazing guest next week as well, and I need to tone down my excitement a bit, because I think this is the kind of thing that wakes Radhika up when I'm recording. So I will see you all next week, and I do have an episode coming out on Tuesday. And as I said, things have been quite crazy and quite hectic, and you will see all the updates on Instagram as to what I've been up to, and on Twitter as well. You will see over the next few days that there is a lot going on in our household in general, but it just brings me so much excitement and so much happiness. I think busy is really a blessing. So I'll see you all next week, and sending you all lots of love.